Well, first of all, I don't know if we'll be able to see the slides.
The lighting situation isn't the best, but
we'll do what we can. I can tell you
it may be boring with the slides, but it would certainly be boring without them.
I was telling Jonathan, probably gave a two-hour slot this afternoon for this talk, which seems to be kind of a mistake, because I can possibly take that and more, and being someone who's able to ramble on at some length about these things, but hopefully this will be of interest to some of you. Those of you that were at the Seeds of Change conference last year can be excused, because this talk is essentially the same as that I gave at that time, and with a few other elaborations. So if you don't want to sit through it again, I fully understand, and I urge you to leave now while the leaving is good. The name of this talk on the program is Alkaloids and Evolution, which is kind of a truncated real title, because we're going to be talking about a lot more than alkaloids, but Alkaloids and Evolution was easy to get on the limited space. What it really should be called is Plant Allelochemicals and Plant-Human Coevolution. But that seemed like somewhat more of a mouthful. And some of what I'm going to talk about today is kind of more established. There's not a whole lot of controversy. The understanding is maybe limited, but most scientists, people that study these things, are in general agreement. And other aspects that I'm going to be talking about are definitely in the realm of speculation. And I'll try to kind of give you notice when we step off into the hypothetical realm and away from the more established areas, just to let you know, if nothing else, that I sort of have a grip on what the difference is. I guess I'll ask for the first slide. The reason I started out with this illustration, which is from the book Parallel Botany, if any of you know that book, it's a charming little book, and it talks about a completely hypothetical, completely fictitious plant kingdom. It's basically a book of anatomy for a bunch of plants that never existed, at least not on this planet. But I put this up here to illustrate the point that even though plants and animals have an extreme relationship of interdependence with each other, plants are not at all like people. And they're not at all really like animals. Even though we as part of the animal kingdom and the rest of the biosphere really depends on plants. For one thing, plants, by and large, don't move around. They are stuck in one place. And so in order to develop evolutionary strategies for protecting themselves, getting along in the world, they have tended to evolve biosynthetic strategies as opposed to behavioral strategies. In fact, one famous botanist, Tony Swain, put it very succinctly. He said, plants have substituted biosynthesis for behavior. And if you think about it, that's an interesting concept. Plants are chemical virtuosos. A greater variety and a greater number of complex organic molecules are found in the plant kingdom than have ever been synthesized by all the organic chemists since the beginning of time. There's plants outstrip them in terms of varieties of different types of compounds. And the reason that plants are able to do this, one of the main contributing factors and the kind of neat trick that plants can do that's unique to the plant kingdom, is that plants are photosynthetic. I put this up here. This is a rendering of the of the cosmic ayahuasca vine by a Brazilian artist. I put it up here to suggest the idea of photosynthesis, actually. I guess I could have put an electron micrograph with a chloroplast or something. But this seemed more appropriate. Plants have this ability to take simple elements, carbon dioxide, water, sunlight, and transform them through the process of photosynthesis into complex organic molecules, the molecules of life, sugars, lipids, amino acids, nucleic acids, all these things basically proceed through the process of photosynthesis. All other organisms in the biosphere are essentially parasites on the plant kingdom. Because, well, not all. I mean, you want to be careful about using those kinds of terms. But most organisms in the biosphere are heterotrophs. That means they don't make their own nutrients. They don't make their own sustenance. Plants are autotrophs. They can, out of sunlight and water and carbon dioxide, manufacture their own food. And that's what the process of photosynthesis is. As energy impinges on this biosphere from outer space, the plants, through chlorophyll, are the first to grab that energy and do something with it. And then from that point, as this electromagnetic energy becomes transformed into chemical energy, it basically cascades through the entire biosphere. Everything else feeds off the plants, but the plants are what is able to fix that energy into the simple sugars. Now, this is a busy slide, and it's probably not visible to most of you, but that's probably just as well. You won't know again that I But this is one of the things that plants can do as a result of their photosynthetic ability. Not only can they make the major molecules of life that we talk about, the sugars, the proteins, the amino acids, all these things that are basically universally distributed in all organisms and upon which we depend for life, these we call primary metabolites. Primary because they're universally distributed and they're pretty much essential for life. But plants, in addition to that, can make a vast array of what is sometimes kind of pejoratively called secondary metabolites. And that is, these are the chemical compounds that make plants interesting, that make them these chemical virtuosos. Plants have energy to burn, so there's because of their photosynthetic ability. So there are no constraints on their energy. They can use that energy and they can seemingly waste it. And for a long time it was thought that these secondary plant metabolites, which are things like alkaloids, terpenoids, your essential oils, your tannins, these sorts of things, are all these plant secondary metabolites. And it was thought that they were secondary because it wasn't really understood what their purpose was. It was thought that they were some kind of metabolic waste product, basically, just a physiological garbage that the plant made and sequestered in its different parts. And what has come to be understood, probably in the last 10 to 15 years, maybe the last 20 years, is that these so-called secondary metabolites, this vast array of structural diversity that plants have evolved, are not really secondary at all. The purpose that they serve the plant is to mediate the relationship between the plant and the rest of its environment, between the other organisms in its environment, from other plants to microorganisms to fungi to grazing animals, and also humans, because we're also organisms in the environment that interact with plants on this molecular level via this molecular language, if you will, that plants have evolved. What this slide illustrates is basically two things. It shows the primary gateway for energy and simple compounds to get into primary metabolism in the plant. That's CO2, water, plus light energy. And that feeds
first into the pentose phosphate cycle, where you get your simple sugars being created, ribulose diphosphate. And then, these are black boxes, you understand. There's a lot more going on here than is implied. But you get first your simple sugars. That leads eventually down the spine of primary metabolism into your tricarboxylic acid cycle, and then on into your amino acids, which lead eventually to proteins, and also your lipids come out of the tricarboxylic acid cycle. This is sort of the spine of primary metabolism. What's perhaps more interesting is that at different branches along the spine, you get things coming out that lead into the major classes of secondary metabolites. For example, coming off the pentose phosphate cycle from the simple sugars, this compound called shikimic acid. And that's your first aromatic compound. Aromatic in the sense, not that it smells good, but aromatic in the sense that chemists use, or that it is the precursor to compounds that contain benzene ring, an aromatic ring. And from shikimate, you get the aromatic amino acids formed, the three essential amino acids, phenylalanine, tyrosine, and tryptophan. And from those, you get a vast array of secondary compounds, the ones that tend to be most, that we tend to be most interested in as psychopharmacologists, are the aromatic alkaloids. An alkaloid, by the way, for those of you that don't already know, is a plant secondary compound, if you will, the pejorative term again, but a plant metabolite that's not part of primary metabolism that contains nitrogen. You can sort of define an alkaloid more easily by what it isn't than what it is. But one of the essential requirements is that alkaloids contain nitrogen. So the aromatic amino acids lead to the aromatic alkaloids, which include things like DMT, psilocybin, multiple hallucinogens, also things like morphine. Many of the drugs of use and abuse that are so economically important are these aromatic alkaloids. In addition to the shikimic acid also gives rise to phenolic compounds such as cinnamic acid, caffeic acid, where these tend to be flavorings and essential oils, flavorings and literally aromatic compounds in the sense of fragrances. This is one of the main branches of primary metabolism that leads to aromatic type compounds. Further down the chain from the Krebs cycle, you get, branching out of the Krebs cycle, you get aliphatic amino acids, things like valine and lysine, that lead to another class of alkaloids, the aliphatic alkaloids, which include things like nicotine. Some of the tropanes are also aliphatic. Pyrrolizidine alkaloids are aliphatic. That is, they don't incorporate an aromatic ring, and they're not derived from one of these three aromatic amino acids that are so important in metabolism. But also, coming off of the Krebs cycle, is a two-carbon fragment called acetyl-CoA. And this two-carbon fragment feeds into a number of secondary product biosynthetic pathways. For one thing, it leads to both fatty acids and lipids, and a class of compounds called the acetogenins, which are just many of these acetyl-CoA units joined together. And you get things like eugenol, belong to the class of acetogenins. But acetyl-CoA can also lead to methylonic acid. And methylonic acid is basically a five-carbon unit that leads to the terpenoids. And you get the terpenoids are down here. You have the simple terpenes like menthol, which basically are 5 or 10 carbon units. You have the sesquiterpenes. One example is picrotoxin. And the diterpenes, you've heard this morning a lot of talk about salvinorin, and that's a classic example of a diterpene. And even more complex terpenes, such as digitalin, and other steroid-related compounds. So these are all basically built up of many units of mevalonic acid joined usually in a head-to-tail fashion. So you have basically four main classes of plant secondary compounds. You have your aromatic chitinic acid derivatives, you've got your aliphatic alkaloids, your acetogenins, and your terpenes. I mean, there are other classes of plant secondary compounds. Those are the four biggies. This is just an example of some alkaloids derived from these different sources. These are aliphatic alkaloids, and these are the aromatic alkaloids. It's quinidine, which is for the quinine tree, cinchona, an important medicine in treating heart arrhythmias. Tumocurarine from curare, that's used in abdominal surgery and other as a muscle relaxant in certain kinds of surgery. There are beta carbolines, also aromatic alkaloids derived from tryptophan. Alkaloids are one of the largest classes of secondary compounds and also one of the most structurally diverse classes of secondary compounds. And also, because we get so many important medicines from them, drugs both of use and abuse, and the distinction is really in how they're used, alkaloids are one of the classes that have the greatest economic importance for us. One of the things that we get from plants that is most important for our health and well-being. This is a slide I haven't put up before, and I'm not sure how much I want to go into it. I don't know exactly how to say this. It's one of the things that's always struck me as curious about the biosynthesis of these aromatic compounds, these things that branch off the chitinate pathway, is what you might call curious parallelisms in biosynthesis. It's either something important or it's so what, ho hum, I'm not sure which. I think it's kind of neat. You know how sometimes people on DMT or sometimes on mushrooms report having the experience that you can kind of turn the circuit board of reality over and see how it's wired, and you realize that, you know, it's not at all what it appears to be. This is sort of on that level. I don't know if that really makes any sense. This particular slide here shows how these three aromatic amino acids arise. This is your CO2 plus H2O plus light. Photosynthesis leads eventually to these two simple sugars, which are formed into chitinic acid and then chorismic acid. And out of that, you get your aromatic amino acids branching off here. Phenylalanine, tyrosine, and tryptophan. And then also other important metabolites, folic acids and so on, which we're not really going to go into here. But then if you look at the classes of secondary compounds that come off of each one, there's something that I always thought was kind of interesting. When you have phenylalanine here and tyrosine. Phenylalanine and tyrosine can basically go two ways. You can get decarboxylation to form the amines, beta-phenethylamine coming from phenylalanine and tyramine coming from tyrosine. So basically you've removed an acid group and you've left the amine intact. And then from these simple amines, you get things like mescaline, which interestingly enough is the only hallucinogenic phenethylamine in nature, although it's given synthetic chemists such as Sasha Shokin many ideas for many analogs, but they're not found in nature. You get neurotransmitters such as dopamine, norepinephrine, or epinephrine, and norepinephrine. Ephedrine, another plant compound that has some of the stimulatory properties of amphetamines. And then even further down the chain, you get complex alkaloids in which these amines, these simple amines, are precursors. They're incorporated into more complex rings, morphine, tributyrarate, and so on. The other thing that can happen to these simple aromatic amino acids is instead of losing a carboxyl group, instead of losing an acid group, they can lose the amine. And then you have your phenylacetic acid derivatives. Things like cinnamic acid, caffeic acid, they can lead, these are widespread in coffee and a lot of spices. They contribute to the flavor of coffee, spices, this sort of thing. Things like safrol and nutmeg, safrol, which is a constituent of nutmeg oil, dill apiol and dill oil, they're also basic simple derivatives of these cinnamic acid derivatives. They are fragrant. Their biological activity is basically that they're volatile. And then these can further join into dimers. They can form dimers and form that class of compounds called lignans, which are things like protophyllotoxin. It's an anti-cancer drug. There are many interesting lignans, and they have a whole range of biological activities, ranging from some are antimicrobial, some are antiviral, and some have activity on the central nervous system. And then if they polymerize even further, you get lignins, which are polymers of these C6, C3 units, the C6 in the ring and the 3 carbon unit sticking out from it. When it becomes polymerized, you get lignin. And lignin is the major structural constituent of wood. Lignin is what gives trees its strength. And interestingly enough, when I was a graduate student at the University of Hawaii, my professor was interested in stress physiology, and he showed that by growing seedlings under conditions of increased gravity, by growing them, he was interested in gravity as a biochemical determinant, and he showed that he would put seedlings in a centrifuge and germinate them there, and show that the levels of lignins were increased, and not only were they increased, if he did anatomy, if he took sections of these seedlings, he showed that the distribution was corresponded with the points of maximum stress in the plant. So this is, you know, lignification, the lignins are deposited on the cell walls. This is basically a gravity-determined property that governs the distribution of these lignins. I mean, if you make an engineering diagram of a tree where the major points of stress are, that will match exactly where the maximum depositions of lignins are. So, you know, whatever. So that's kind of the story with the aromatic amino acids, phenylalanine and tyrosine, the precursor of the phenethylamines, and the complex alkaloids that come off that. And then this class of compounds, the essential oils and the lignans, and then the lignan itself. Well, if you look at the same thing with respect to tryptophan, it's kind of the opposite. Tryptophan can be decarboxylated or deaminated. If you remove the amine group of tryptophan, what you're left with is indoleacetic acid. Indoleacetic acid, it turns out, is one of the major plant growth hormones. It's the plant hormone that's universally distributed in plants, and it governs the elongation of the plant stem and cell division. So this is basically a very important plant growth hormone. But it doesn't seem to go, there's not a vast array, unlike with the deamination products of phenylalanine and tyrosine, with the indole, there's not a vast array of secondary compounds based on indole acetic acid. I mean, there are variations. But it hasn't efflorescent into a great variety. Where you see the variety in the indole is when you lose the carboxyl group, you get the simple tryptamine. You get tryptamine. And then leading to that, you get your other compounds like 5-methoxy-DMT, dimethyltryptamine, by adding methyl groups. When you add a hydroxyl group in this position, you get 5-hydroxytryptamine, which is a major neurotransmitter, as you all know, also known as serotonin. Again, I don't know if this is neat or ho-hum. It's always struck me as interesting. A dimethyltryptamine is basically two steps of a tryptophan. I mean, tryptophan is universally distributed in nature. Here, two enzymatic steps away is dimethyltryptamine. The curious thing about dimethyltryptamine, if you all know, is it's not orally acting. So it could be widely distributed in a lot of foods that we eat, and we never know it unless we happen to fortuitously also eat a plant containing an MAO inhibitor at the same time. Then you know. But you know, you might be happily dining on plants, cereals, for example, high in dimethyltryptamine for a long time. If you never combined it with an MAO inhibitor, you wouldn't know. But these tryptamines, there's quite a structural variety within the tryptamines of these simple things. And then even more complex, you get the next step is beta-carbolines, and then there's a whole vast array of more or less complex indole alkaloids, things like ibogaine, and even more complex, enormous things like vincristine, which is one of the more complex indole alkaloids. This, of course, is an anti-cancer drug. It's used to treat leukemia in children. Rumor has it that it's also psychedelic, or not psychedelic, psychoactive. People undergoing cancer chemotherapy have reported interesting experiences after being treated with vincristine. I don't recommend it. It's not something that I would care to try. But another interesting thing, when we saw that in the phenylalanine and tyrosine class, when you get polymerization into the lignans, it becomes the structural component of trees. What happens when the indoles polymerize? You get melanin. And melanin is the black pigment that makes many mushrooms turn black. It's the black pigment when bananas begin to turn black on the outside. That is melanin. And melanin is an indole polymer, basically. The curious thing is that in nature, it doesn't really usually come from indoles at all. It comes from tyrosine, dopamine, and these phenethylamine-type compounds. So, you know, go figure. Anyway, this just gives you, I guess the point that I'm trying to bring out from all this is that depending on which way it goes, these aromatic amino acids can lead into major secondary product pathways, into large categories of compounds that are basically derived from these things. And if you go decarboxylation, you lead into one category. If you go deamination, removing the nitrogen, lead into the other category. And there's a kind of a symmetry here. I mean, I haven't got it completely figured out, but it's interesting to me that it exists. This is another example. Sasha Shulgin has talked about the essential amphetamines. Interesting thing. You know, in nature, the only CNS-active phenethylamine, the only hallucinogenic phenethylamine is mescaline, which is 3,4,5 trimethoxyphenethylamine. But some of these essential oils, Elomycin from nutmeg, acerone from, of course, calamus, the sweet flag, these sorts of things, if you make it, you know, they themselves are not psychoactive, but if you make a trivial synthetic modification, if you introduce a molecule of ammonia into this at the right position, then you get your essential amphetamines, the simplest and probably the most obvious one, which is 3,4,5-trimethoxyamphetamine. You can think of it as a mescaline analog, which it certainly is, but it's also, and it can be made directly from Elomycin by simply adding an ammonia at this position. Similarly, if you take acerone and do the same type of ammonia substitution, you get TMA2, where the essential difference between these two is the position of the epoxy groups, where they are located on the ring. This is 3,4,5, this is 2,4,5. And one of the most interesting discoveries Dr. Shulgin made when he was working on this early on, back in the late 50s, was that this simple, trivial rearrangement, the movement moving this one from here to here, from the three position to the two position, resulted in an enhancement of potency of orders of magnitude. Sasha's here. Correct me if I misrepresent any of it. But then he found that by making various substitutes so that it's the 2-4-5 configuration was important, and then various substitutes on this core position, basically he could hang just about anything he wanted off that and still get some kind of activity. So he started hanging things like halogens off it, or methyl groups. He first came up with BOM, which was known a few years ago as STP, but then perhaps the most potent ones, where this R group becomes things like bromine or iodine, you get DOB and DOI, and these are very potent phenethylamines. They're not quite as potent as LSD, but they're in that magnitude. 1 milligram or less is a you know, above threshold dose. They're also extremely selective for the 5-HT2 receptors, which is this class of receptors, serotonin receptors, that they now believe is intimately involved in the action of these hallucinogens.